So again, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is Mitchell Warren from AVAC and delighted to welcome you all to another in our series of webinars, which I will describe in just a minute. But really want to welcome you all to really part two of the series, in a sense. For many of you, you may know that late last year, AVAC launched its annual AVAC report focused on research and reality. And over the last 6 months, we've had a series of webinars looking at different aspects of both prevention research and rollout activities around the world in different areas of the world, in different areas of the prevention and treatment continuum. We're really delighted to start the second half of the year with a series of calls building on of the AIDS 2014 conference that took place in July in Melbourne, where there were a number of updates on critical issues along the research to rollout continuum. And we decided that it would be really useful to ensure that the conversations in Melbourne didn't stop in Melbourne, and that we would put together a series of calls over the next 6 weeks or so, covering a number of issues that will highlight presentations and conversations that happened in Melbourne, and to keep that conversation going. Hopefully many of you are on this call because you received our Advocates Network message about this webinar series. If you didn't and want more information, if you go to avac.org, you will find the calendar there. We have the call obviously starting right now, and then in 2 weeks' time, there will be another call, and then each week thereafter on Wednesdays through around the middle of October on different aspects of post-Melbourne activities. And again, I'll be describing some of that at the end of the call just so you know what's coming next. But today, I'm really delighted to welcome an incredible researcher who presented on the first day of the Melbourne conference in plenary on the state of the art of HIV cure research. And Jintanat Ananawaranich from the U.S. HIV Military Research Program really provided both a remarkably updated scientific presentation, as well as doing it in a way that I think was approachable and understandable to a range of audiences, irrespective of their scientific literacy. So it was really pretty clear to us at AVAC that not only was HIV cure research a critical issue to be discussing as part of this webinar series, but that Jintanat would be the perfect kickoff given her terrific plenary presentation there. Jintanat has been at the U.S. Military HIV Research Program for just a little while as its Associate Director for Therapeutics Research, but has a long and distinguished career working in Thailand and around the world on therapeutic research, I won't go through her entire CV. I will also say, though, that the Military HIV Research Program website does have loaded onto it at hivresearch.org Jintanat's original presentation, which is longer than what you're going to hear today. So if you do find yourself yearning for more information, you can find it at the hivresearch.org website, and we'll be providing those links again at the end. But wanted to make sure you knew you could find more information. The format for today is going to be that Jintanat's going to present a modified version of her plenary talk over the next 15 or 20 minutes. We will then open it up for questions, and there are multiple ways to ask questions, and I want to describe them now because at least two of those ways you can be asking questions as she goes. So as Jintanat's presenting, you are welcome to email to avac@avac.org any questions that come up. We won't be stopping to answer them right away, but we will be putting them in the queue so that we can provide them to her immediately after the presentation. You can also, if you're on the web interface, you can ask questions in the chat box quite easily. And again, we'll keep those in the queue so that we can ask her at the end of the talk. And then finally, after her talk, I will describe again how to mute and unmute your line so that you can unmute, ask your question. We do ask that you mute again to keep the line nice and clear, because we'll be posting this on the website as a recording along with her slides. And then we'll go from there. So again, we really are looking forward to this presentation and most of all to the discussion to follow. So with that, it is with great pleasure that I'm able to introduce Jintanat Ananawaranich from the U.S. Military HIV Research Program and from the Thai Red Cross to present to us on the state of the art of HIV cure, where we are now and where we're going.
Thank you very much. Could you hear me?
I can indeed. You are loud and clear.
Okay. Thanks so much. So I would like to thank AVAC for giving me this opportunity to share with you parts of my presentation at the IAS in Melbourne, and I'm really grateful to everyone who has joined us today and very much look forward to hearing your thoughts and comments at the end of the presentation. So next slide, please. So in the next 20 minutes, I would like to first talk about what we've learned so far, if HIV cure is possible, and why HIV persistence is pertinent to cure. And then I will touch on the promising cure strategies and then discuss the ethical and social considerations in HIV cure and cure research. And at the IES, I also had a short movie of four Thais with HIV who shared what HIV cure meant to them. And this is posted at our MHRP website and also at the IAS website. So I do hope that at the end of the presentation, you will have a better understanding of how much progress we've made and where we will go in the future. So HIV cure is possible, and the Berlin patient is the only person to date that HIV has potentially been eradicated. And he's now been off HIV treatment for more than 6 years with no HIV detected. His treatment was bone marrow transplantation for his leukemia, but the donor cells lack both of the CCR5 genes, and therefore the cells had no CCR5 receptor for HIV to enter. And this is not a therapy we would do in people without cancer, but his therapy, even though it had limited relevance to practical cure, it did teach us that eliminating CCR5 positive cells is important. So we know that in almost everyone who stopped their antiretroviral treatment, the viral load will rebound very fast in a matter of 2 to 4 weeks. But in the two Boston patients and in the Mississippi child, they were able to achieve longer period of viral load suppression, which we also call HIV remission. So in the Boston patients, they had bone marrow transplantation for cancer, but in contrast to the Berlin patient, the donor cells did have the CCR5 co-receptors. After transplantation while on therapy, they had no HIV detected, but when ART was stopped, the viral load rebounded in 3 months in one patient and 7 months in the other. In the case of the Mississippi child, she was treated extremely early from 31 hours of life until age 18 months. And subsequently, after coming off treatment, she was able to remain with undetectable viral load for almost 2.5 years before viral load rebounded in July of this year. So this is a remarkable progress for our field because we now learn that very early ART could lead to a significantly longer time to viral load rebound. And in both cases, they had undetectable HIV while on treatment in the cells and in the case of the Boston patients in the tissue. So they illustrate an important point that we do not yet know what the biomarkers for HIV remission are. So HIV persistence is a major barrier to HIV cure because small numbers of cells that have HIV integrated into them can remain in a resting state where they do not actively produce virus, and these cells are not seen by the HIV medications nor the immune system and can persist for a very long time. And the way we currently measure the HIV reservoir is that we measure the amount of HIV in the cell called HIV DNA. But we also know that a lot of the DNA is actually defective. So it is important also to measure how much HIV is alive by measuring the replication-competent virus. But recent data have shown us that there are actually more viruses that are actually intact and are able to replicate, but they're currently not being measured. So right now, many groups of researchers are working together to try to improve the methods on how we measure the reservoir. And we also know that HIV also hides in organs such as the brain, and this is very difficult to measure. So it may be very important for achieving HIV remission to understand the amount and the location of the latent virus, and also the amount and the quality of the HIV-specific immunity. And here in this picture, you can see that the latent virus, the amount of it, in the Boston patients and in the Mississippi child was extremely low. But in all of these cases, the immune cells were also naive to HIV, meaning that the cases had no HIV-specific immunity. In the Boston patients, this was because they were transplanted with cells from uninfected persons who've never seen HIV before. In the Mississippi child, she was a newborn with little memory CD4 T cells whose HIV was suppressed so fast with HIV medication before immunity could develop. So this possibly resulted in their inability to kill all of the HIV-infected cells. And so the very few cells that had HIV that were not able to be detected by the current methods were then, with time, the virus was able to replicate, and then we saw a rebound in the blood. So here it also gives us a unique opportunity to work on both of these to try to push the time to viral load rebound even further. We could reduce the reservoir further by either starting ART earlier, giving ART for longer, or using drugs with better penetration. And we can improve the HIV-specific immunity by giving vaccination and other immune-based therapy. So I would like to now talk about some of the exciting innovations that are being tested for cure. We could potentially intervene even before HIV infection by giving HIV vaccine. If infection occurs, we could give ART during acute infection that will reduce the viral load rapidly. Even if infection is discovered later, it's still important to start treatment to reduce the total amount of virus in the body. And once the virus is suppressed in the blood, there are other interventions that we could consider to eliminate the infected cells. And this slide shows extremely impressive data from a study in macaques that were immunized with a vaccine given in an attempt to prevent SIV infection. And SIV is an HIV-like infection in monkeys. After vaccination, actually, all of the monkeys became infected, so the vaccine did not prevent infection. But what it did was that it eradicated SIV in half of the monkeys. And so in this graph, you can see on the y-axis is the plasma viral load in log. And on the x-axis is the time since infection. And each line represents an animal. And so the bunch of blue lines on top showed 7 of 16 animals who actually had high viral load. They were non-controllers. But the different color lines on the bottom show 9 macaques that were infected, but then they were able to control virus. And what is most surprising is that in all but one monkey, the SIV infection was completely eradicated from the blood and from all organs. And this eradication of SIV infection is likely because the CMV vector used in this vaccine was a replicating vector that could generate ongoing immune responses that got rid of all of the infected cells. And actually, human studies now are currently being planned. One of the best-known cohorts in the world on the benefit of early ART is perhaps the Visconti cohort of post-treatment controllers, and these are 14 adults from France who started ART within the first 3 months of infection, And after about 3 years of ART, they stopped the treatment and have had undetectable viral load in the blood for now more than 5 years. And so we all know many people who, when they stop treatment, the virus comes back very fast. So why are these people different? So there are still ongoing investigations, but so far they don't seem to have the favorable genetic profile or poor viral fitness. What is unique about these individuals is that they have very low HIV DNA, and the HIV DNA are preferentially in shorter-lived CD4 T cells that are easier for the immune system to get rid of. And the fact that their reservoir is not mainly in long-lived T cells are really different to what we see in most people. Our group has also shown that early ART during acute infection may limit infection in the long-lived CD4 T cells. And here in the RV254 SURGE 10 study that our group, the U.S. Military HIV Research Program, is conducting with the Thai Red Cross AIDS Research Center, we diagnose and treat people very early in acute infection. And when we looked at the long-lived central memory CD4 T cells, we see that the earlier someone is treated, the better. And here you can see the integrated HIV DNA in 1 million cells in the y-axis. And in the group in red, these are people who got treatment within the first 2 weeks of infection, and all of them had no detectable integrated HIV DNA. In those treated during chronic stage in green, infection of in these memory CD4 T cells are detected and will remain high for a long time. So although we are encouraged by these results, we still don't know if these people will be able to achieve HIV remission. But I would like to note that the majority of these patients do develop HIV-specific immunity after ART, so they could very well be different than the Boston patients and the Mississippi child who had a naive immune system. So once viral load is suppressed in the blood, what else can we do? And here is an example of a trial that gave a drug that could wake up the virus in latently infected cells. And this is a trial using pinobinostat, which is an HDAC inhibitor, a latency-reversing agent. In the graph on the y-axis shows the increase in cell-associated HIV RNA, which is what we want to see. And in the x-axis shows the days of treatment, and the yellow highlighted bars are when the drug was given. So you can see that over time, the virus was actually reactivated when pinobinostat was given, which is what we wanted to see. However, when the replication-competent virus, how much virus is alive, was measured, they were not lower. So what this ultimately showed us was that the virus was shocked out of latency, but it was not killed. So how do we then kill HIV-infected cells? And this can be done by using HIV vaccines, and there are many that are being studied currently. And another method that our group is interested in is using broadly neutralizing antibody. And we know that ART can block HIV infection of cells, but the antibody shown here on the in the Y-shaped blue color can possibly do more. It can bind and clear cell-free virus and also help to eliminate HIV-infected cells. And here in macaques infected with chronic SHIV, and this is simian human immunodeficiency virus, that were given PGT-121 broadly neutralizing antibody, they had a significantly drop in their plasma viral load and also their HIV DNA. And here in the graph, you can see the viral load log on the y-axis and the x-axis showing days after infusion. And these are data from three macaques that had low baseline plasma viral load. And just by getting PGT-121, these macaques were able to achieve SHIV remission. With suppression of viral load, and Dr. Baruch has updated us during the IS that now after 1 year, they are still viral load suppressed long after the level of antibody had disappeared from the circulation. So there are now many antibodies that have been identified, and several human studies are underway. Our group is conducting the RV397 and 398 studies in acute infection, and RV397 will give VRC01 broadly neutralizing antibody in treated acutely infected ties, and we could see whether we could help them achieve HIV remission after ART interruption. So another way to eliminate HIV is to eliminate the CCR5 co-receptor, and a group of investigators did this in 12 patients by taking a lot of cells from the patient by leukapheresis, then modifying these cells using zinc finger nuclease to basically cut the CCR5 gene, and then reinfuse these modified cells shown in green back into the patient. And they found that the HIV DNA was lower. However, after interrupting ART in all of the patients, all except one had viral load rebound. And the one patient that actually resuppressed the viral load himself was a person who lacked one of the CCR5 genes naturally, and he had the highest engraftment of these modified cells. So if we summarize the different interventions that are being studied for HIV cure, one is minimizing the reservoir with early treatment. We could then shock the virus by reactivating the latently infected cells and then kill the latently infected cells by immune system. Finally, we could transfuse cells that lack the CCR5 genes. But ultimately, I think it is very likely that we will need combination therapy to be able to achieve cure. I would like now to discuss important issues that we need to carefully consider, and these are the social and ethical implications of HIV cure and cure research. What eradication means and how it's perceived across settings and cultures may be very different. It could mean being normal or free of disease or simply being healed. And we know that many people suffer from long-term consequences of HIV, and so even if they've been cured, they may be experiencing a new normal, such as a cancer survivor. And it's likely that we will continue to require long-term viral load monitoring when we are trying to achieve HIV remission. We don't know also people who have been cured or who have been able to achieve HIV remission if HIV stigma and discrimination will persist. And as you've heard, we don't know yet what the best measure for the reservoir is, so to be able to call someone cured is very difficult. So it may be better to use the word HIV remission in a way that the Forum Cure Project has proposed, is to state viral suppression of ART and simply just stating what level of viral load undetectability and the time of ART we are reporting. So in this next slide, the Australian participants of a trial that used varinostat to reactivate the latent reservoir were asked about their priorities on outcomes of cure research. And it is very interesting that the most important outcome for them is to not pass the virus to others, and the second most important outcomes were to not get HIV again and to not be considered as an infected person. And so the stopping of medication was less important, and this is actually the goal that we're trying to achieve with HIV remission. The ethics of cure is also challenging, and it's likely that the ideal candidates, particularly for initial trials, will be persons who are well with viral suppression, and it's likely they're on very easy to take, well-tolerated medication. And some interventions, such as the latency-reversing agents, are actually cancer therapy that have potential toxicity. To test for HIV remission, ART interruption will be required, and I do believe that we can do this safely with very close monitoring of viral load. And in our studies, we will be monitoring viral load twice weekly to once weekly so the treatment could be resumed immediately if someone does not control the virus. And many of the interventions we're studying now are still costly, and so accessibility to trials and to interventions, particularly in resource-limited settings, are also important ethical considerations. So what might the future look like? And we are very fortunate that there are many groups that are working together to try to bring stakeholders together to pursue the common goal of HIV cure. And these are the IAS Towards HIV Cure Initiative, the U.S. NIH Commitment Towards HIV Cure, and the Focus on Cure by AVEC and others. And there are exciting new data from non-human primate and human studies that will help us to pave the way for what the future may look like. And there are, of course, many challenges, but the field is energized, and I do believe that it is possible that one day we will have a preventive vaccine that could prevent HIV in most people. And in those who do become infected, a vaccine could potentially help the immune system manage the virus and limit the reservoir. And early diagnosis and treatment will become the standard of care worldwide, and the momentum is already there. This will improve the health of people who are infected as well as reduce transmission rates. And we've seen that many novel therapies are now being pursued, and these could possibly eliminate cells capable of producing virus. So these are the goals that together we could work towards achieving. I'm extremely grateful to our volunteers in our acute HIV infection study and our pediatric studies and the dedicated research teams and all of these people. I'm very grateful to them. They helped me in putting the presentation for the IAS plenary talk together. So thank you very much for your attention, and I'd be very happy to discuss this further and hear your comments and input. Thank you.
Great. Jintanat, thank you so very, very much. That was a tour de force, not unlike in Melbourne, and incredibly grateful for the clarity you've provided throughout that presentation. A number of questions have come in, and we hope for many more. Let me just remind you all that you can continue to email at avac@avac.org. You can use the chat feature if you're following along with the slides on online. And in just a minute, we will go ahead and open up the line for questions. You'll be able to hit *7. Let me just make sure you all see this. You'll need to hit *7 to unmute your slide, and then *6 again to mute yourself again to keep the line nice and clear. We would ask that you introduce yourself when you ask your question. But one logistics question that came up from a couple of people via email is, can we have copies of this presentation? And so let me just say up front that the recording of this call and the slides will be available on the AVAC website, avac.org/research-reality, and that is not only for this webinar, but all of them in the series are available there. In addition, Jintanat mentioned that at the end of the Melbourne plenary, she provided a brief video of participants in some of the trials taking place in Thailand of their individual perspectives about cure research from the very personal points of view of what they were looking for. And again, you saw just a couple of slides ago, Jintanat presenting some Australian data, but this really presented the Thai community perspective on cure, and that is available at the MHRP website, hivresearch.org, and we will provide a link there as well, along with the recording and these slides. So I really encourage you all to take advantage of that. So again, multiple ways to ask questions. There was a question that came up that I think maybe I'll start with Jintanat, if I may. You know, many of the examples that we've heard both in your presentation and over the last couple of years, really, have emanated from research in the U.S. and in Europe. And you very happily presented the increasing research activity around cure research taking place in Thailand. But one of our advocacy partners in Africa asked the question, given the burden of disease in Africa, if you have a sense of when CURE research might reach activities in Africa on the ground.
Thank you very much. And you're completely correct that very little CURE research is being done in resource-limited settings at the moment. If you look at clinicaltrials.gov, actually, they're very few. Our group, MHRP, will be doing a study, the RV398, which we will give the VRC01 broadly neutralizing antibody at time of acute infection in order to limit the reservoir size. We will be doing that in three countries in Africa as well as Thailand. So I think that's coming along, and in terms of broadly neutralizing antibody, of course, you know, it's very particular to HIV clades and subtypes. So there are many of them that are active against subtypes seen in Africans. So we're very much looking forward to starting that study very soon.
Great. Thank you so much. And actually, another question came in a couple of times, it may be the perfect next step given what you just said about the neutralizing antibodies. A number of the advocates on the call have been eagerly watching over the last several years around the discovery of these neutralizing antibodies. And the early conversations were the thought that these neutralizing antibodies might be the basis for vaccines. So a question came in, are the antibodies you described in your presentation for potential use in CURE strategies, are they the same as the antibodies being discussed in the vaccine field, or are they different, or might we see the same antibodies used in different ways?
Yes, the antibodies that we're talking about now are going to be used currently for passive immunization. So what we're trying to do is try to reduce the reservoir size to the minimum if it's given early, and also try to help patients remain with virulosuppression when they come off ART. There are a lot of research effort trying to learn from these broadly neutralizing antibody in terms of how to use this knowledge to develop vaccine, vector-based vaccine, to be able to produce these types of broadly neutralizing antibody. And there are studies being done in mice and also in monkeys at the moment. In the past, the type of antibodies that have been generated, for instance, from the RV144 vaccines are not the same as these broadly neutralizing antibodies.
Great. Thank you so much. There are a number of other questions that have come in. Let me just pause to let those on the line who I know have signaled desires to ask questions. If people online want to hit *7 to unmute your line, and please introduce yourself and go ahead and ask. All right. Well, you're thinking of your question. Let me ask another one that has come in, which actually relates to something that you had asked or that you had mentioned toward the end of your presentation, Cincinnati, that you said that early treatment would become the global standard, and someone on the line was asking, how early would that be?
Yes, that's a question we don't know the answer to, but I would say the earlier the better, but you know, what we see now is that even though ARV is available and in many settings ARV is being recommended for everyone, for instance, in Thailand, ARV is recommended for everyone who's HIV infected regardless of CD4, but we're continuing to see people starting treatment at very low CD4. And so if you've had years and years of viral replication, there's so much viral reservoir there, it's going to be very difficult to eliminate all of the infected cells. So I would say that if people are able to access early diagnosis, even with just the standard fourth-generation antigen-antibody combo assay with routine testing, to be able to capture people within the first 6 months or a year, that's already much better than what we're doing now. Of course, with these initial proof of concept trials, what we're trying to do is to catch people within the first month of infection. And here, you know, we need the more than just the fourth generation enzyme immunoassay to do this for research. But we really don't know what the critical window of opportunity is. If you look at the Visconti cohort, I mean, they're not the super early people. They were treated within the first 3 months. And I think if people can access routine testing with sensitive methods like a fourth-generation assay, we can very well capture people within the first 3 months. And this is something we have to accumulate knowledge to know, you know, how early do we have to be.
Great. Now, that's super, super helpful. And I think one of the things that your point highlights is that the environment in which this research will be taking place over the coming years will be very different than the environment over the last several years, given changes in treatment guidelines and clinical practice in different countries around the world. So, you know, the science will continue to evolve as will clinical practice. There are a couple of questions that have come in about terminology and in different ways. And so maybe I'll focus a bit on those for just a moment. One person asked a really fascinating question that you presented information from Australians who were involved in cure research who talked about no longer being able to infect others as their priority. And the question is, do you imagine that there may be some confusion in the community of people living with HIV about the term remission, if this desire to not infect others, you know, the kind of prevention benefit is what weighs heavy? Is remission the right term, and how might that play out in people's minds about what they're getting in all of this?
Definitely. I do completely agree that it's very confusing, and we're not sure, I think, at this point how best to call all this. And it's an evolving field, and the terms will evolve as well. And, you know, when we talk about HIV remission at the moment, we're talking about having undetectable plasma viral load. And although most people who have undetectable plasma viral load will have undetectable viral load in the genital secretion, it's not always the case. So there may be a small chance of people who are in remission who could possibly transmit infection, and this is something we have to continue to follow. And I imagine that if we start to see HIV remission in some of the people with the interventions we're studying, we would be testing for viral load in the genital secretions also to try to understand this risk.
That's a really great point. And I think, and at the very end of the call, I'm going to describe an effort around broader community engagement and research literacy around cure. But I think some of these issues of terminology is not just about the scientific pursuit and the conversation among scientists, but also engaging the community at large and really making sure there's clarity about what is happening and what we're calling things. So we'll come back to that. One of the things that I think was important about what you presented this morning and in Melbourne too was you focused not only on the science, but you yourself raised the issues of ethics. And another great question came in on the chat line here. How should research ethics committees determine risks in these complicated and exploratory trials? I mean, this is new territory in many respects for researchers, for trial participants, but also for research ethics committees. So what is your sense of how that risk determination will get made, and what are the issues people should be aware of?
I think that it's quite difficult for the IRB, actually, because this is very new. And I would say that the initial trials, as an investigator, we would include a very small number of people to mitigate the risk. We have, in one of our trials, we're doing a stage-wise enrollment. For instance, you enroll the first 8 or 9, and then if you see one success, then you move on to the next stage or so, in order to limit the number of people who could be exposed to the risk. I would say that we have to be very clear that there's no benefit to the participants they could be benefit to the larger scientific group, but not to the participants who are enrolling in the trial, that they have to have true understanding of what this means. And you know, we discuss this a lot, and we don't put the word cure in any of our consent form, because I think that once, even if you just mention that this is a study towards achieving cure, it could really bias the people and give false expectation. And we're in a very early stage, and actually we're developing a sub-study to look at how people make decisions in terms of their willingness to participate or their preference to decline these trials, what goes into their decision making and what is their expectation. And we hope to learn about this more as we go along with all the different trials. But definitely the initial trials will be quite risky for the participants, because there will be toxicities. We don't know what will happen with the treatment interruption, although that part I think probably is safer than the drug being given itself, because if you do viral load monitoring very frequently, you can go back on treatment promptly, and I think that the risk there may be lower than actually giving drugs with toxicity. But all this is very important to continue to capture and continue to evolve as we learn more.
Great, Jinsa. Thank you. That was terrific.
Hello. Sorry.
Yes. Go ahead.
Hi. My name is Veronica Nozid. I'm calling from France. Just about this last point, can I ask a question, please?
Please do.
Yes, because you said that perhaps we are going to go through clinical trials with the treatment interruptions. I wanted to know how far are these trials? Are there trials ongoing or in preparation now? How far are those clinical trial with for example, not kick and kill, but, you know, just early treatment and treatment
right.
interruption, please. Thanks.
Thank you.
For the great presentation, which was really, really nice. Thanks.
Thank you very much. So we have a trial called RV411 that we're conducting in Thailand in the early treated acutely infected people. And this is a trial that is being funded by the U.S. National Institute of Health. And this trial is going to be submitted to the IRB very soon, and we hope to start by the end of the year. And in this trial, we're enrolling people who are treated in the earlier stage of acute infection in FEBIC 1. So these are people who were treated when they only had viral RNA positive, and the P24 antigen and all the antibodies were still negative. And they've been on treatment for at least 2 to 3 years. And we will interrupt 9 people first, and then do viral load very frequently, twice weekly or once weekly. And we will resume treatment if the viral load is above 1,000 or if it is rising very rapidly. So that's our first trial. The other trials that will have to look at antibody or vaccine will come next year. But we're trying to use the same criteria for treatment interruption and treatment resumption across trials in order to try to understand the predictors for viral load control. And other people, the ACTG also has a trial that they're developing, but that's a stage-wise enrollment also. They will enroll chronically infected people first to try to determine predictors for viral load rebound or time to viral load rebound, and then move on to the acutely infected people later.
Great. Thanks, Jinsa, and thank you, Veronica, for the question. Two just very quick things to say as resources for people. Jinsa mentioned both some trials but also some funding, and I did want to let people know, those of you who have worked with AVAC on prevention activities over the years, you will know that we do a lot of work to track both the resources invested in research as well as the database of trials that are happening, and I'm happy to say that we've integrated CURE into both of those efforts, and in fact, in Melbourne, at the IAS meeting, we launched, along with a number of partners, IAS and AMFAR and the Treatment Action Group, the latest resource tracking data about where investments are coming from in the HIV CURE space, and the prevention research and development database now includes some and soon all of the cure research that's happening that she's not just described. So you'll be able to search on where that funding is going as well. So two resources just to make people aware of. A number of questions have come in related to some of the science, and maybe I'll have you take a chance of answering some of these, Jintanat. One question came in and said, of the current approaches to cure research that you described, which of these could possibly result in immunity so that after being, you know, quote-unquote cured, you wouldn't get reinfected with HIV? Are any of the strategies on that line of thinking right now?
I think that's probably a goal for the future. Right now, I think that, for instance, the latency reversing agents or the broadly neutralizing antibodies, those probably would not have an effect in preventing reinfection. The HIV vaccines, however, could have an effect, and I think that it may be that we would be giving vaccines for a period of time and need boosting over time, and potentially those could have an effect on reinfection. But that's such a difficult goal to achieve at this point. I think, you know, with the Mississippi trial rebounding and the Boston patients, I think we've really kind of lessened our at least immediate goal to trying to achieve sustained HIV remission as the goal that could be achievable in the near future.
So not unlike with preventive vaccine research, keeping one's expectations modest and letting science surprise us, but without getting our expectations ahead of the science, I think is an important reminder you're providing. A couple of questions came in actually from a giant in the AIDS vaccine research field, who asked a question about Dan Baruch's work that you referred to in one of your slides, and as you said, he provided some additional information at the IAS meeting of studies in primates and human studies that suggest that any viremia leads to seeding or reseeding of the reservoir, and therefore doesn't the shock element that you described reseed the reservoir? And the question is what's your sense of that?
I think that if you provide the shock therapy while there's still another therapy to suppress the virus, you could prevent the reseeding of the reservoir. But of course, if you give the shock therapy in the absence of ART, there is a chance that it could reseed the reservoir. I think the problem with the shock therapy at the moment is that the shock is not enough shock, because the amount of viremia that arise, even in the recent trial from Denmark using romidepsin, the amount of viral load that we're seeing is actually very low. It's, you know, between 50 copies to 100 copies. It's not really a major shock at this point. And so I think the question for the shock therapy is more by itself. It probably will not be very effective, but if it's combined with something else, such as immune-based therapy, that may be the way to go.
Great, and I think one of your slides for me was really kind of the take-home slide about the issue of combination cure. You know, we've always talked about combination treatment, combination prevention, and it seems on your presentation and on this answer just now that combination cure is going to be critical as well. There's a second part to the question, too, that strong evidence that cure requires elimination of infected cells. The question, what is the status of investigations of this approach?
For instance, the shock therapy that I showed, I mean, it didn't really result in elimination of infected cells. In the broadly neutralizing antibody, there is evidence that it does help to eliminate HIV-infected cells, but there's still a question of whether it could eliminate latently infected cells. So if cells do not express HIV on its surface, can broadly neutralizing antibody actually eliminate these cells? This is also an unknown question. I think the most probably, to me, effective way is really to boost the immune system with active immunization, to either boost the cytotoxic T cell response and to try to eliminate HIV-infected cells. I think that, in my mind, that is actually the way to go in the future. And we are trying to study that in our patient population as well.
Great. You know, one of the things you've raised a couple of times, and a number of questions have come in about testing and about acute infection. And one question came from someone who said, for a person outside of a trial setting in a community with primarily third generation testing, what is the best way to find out if there is acute infection? Should people be seeking out, should people in who are newly diagnosed seek out a special test that will tell them if their infection is recent? And the related question about this is needing to identify people so early in infection. And is there a case for self-testing as part of a global standard going forward?
Yes, I think that one thing that could be helpful is people are aware that that acute retroviral syndrome could occur in the majority of people who have acute infection, and if they have had high-risk exposure with symptoms consistent with acute retroviral syndrome, I think that's one sign that we could consider as early infection. In terms of people who are getting tested with third-generation enzyme immunoassay, if this is in a setting where HIV medication is not offered to everyone, of course, if it's offered to everyone, I do believe that it's helpful. It's beneficial to start treatment whenever you know that you're HIV infected. But if it's not the case and someone is shown to be positive by third generation enzyme immunoassay, there are other ways we could use the fourth generation antigen antibody combo assay to see whether that is still positive, or we could use even a less sensitive method using second generation EIA, and if that's negative and the third generation is positive, then that could be early treatment. But, you know, the time window between these tests being positive and negative is so small. I think that, you know, if it's done systematically, the best way is actually to use fourth generation EIA as screening, and then use the less sensitive, such as third or second, as the second test. If your fourth generation is positive but your less sensitive EIA is negative, then you're probably within the acute infection window. Nucleic acid testing is another way to do. If people have really high risk exposure, particularly they have acute retroviral symptoms, if they're testing negative to an HIV test, and we could do HIV viral load or HIV DNA, and that's positive, that's also evidence for acute infection. Now, I do think that the way we do our trials in Thailand is probably not doable in most places, because we screen in real time with nucleic acid testing. It's very costly. But just screening with fourth generation EIA and finding people who are positive and putting them on treatment as soon as you know, and for people to know that nowadays, if you have an exposure, you can come in within the first 2 weeks or 4 weeks for testing. The window period is not 3 to 6 months anymore. That's already very helpful.
Great. Thank you so much, Insan. I do want to do two quick things at the end, but one final question did just come in. On the therapeutic side, could it be that therapy is not thorough enough as well in terms of the strategies you're describing? And the question, how fast or how well can drugs soak up the shock? And is the interplay there?
I think the therapies are really very good nowadays to suppress the viral load. And I, with terms of the shock therapy, I really don't think that the fact that it's activating the virus producing very low-level virus in the presence of ART, that that would be harmful. I think what we worry about more actually is kind of the initial treatment and trying to get the viral load down as fast as possible in the blood and in the tissue. And we know that many drugs do not penetrate the tissue very well. And so the time that the body has to keep producing more virus in tissue and feeding the reservoir there with when therapy is being initiated, I think that's more of an issue than the current shock therapy that we have that I think could do as much harm.
Great, Chintana, thank you so much. Your presentation so clear and so comprehensive, and your response to these questions and your time, we were all so very grateful. And a number of comments that came in with their questions, I should have said, all began with great presentation. I do want to so thank you very, very much and remind everybody that there'll be a link to the call recording and to the slides on the AVAC website. You'll also see the registration there for subsequent calls in the series. The next one taking place in 2 weeks' time, September 17th, same time, Wednesday, September 17th, is focusing on the latest developments in voluntary medical male circumcision research and implementation. There was a large number of really exciting presentations around circumcision that took place in Melbourne, and really want to encourage everybody to that call, and you'll see registration link there and for all of the subsequent calls in the series. But before we end, I do want to highlight one other piece about cure-related research, and that really is focused on how we collectively go forward, both as researchers and as advocates, and want to make sure you're all aware of a really exciting project that's a partnership amongst a number of international advocacy groups, community advisory board members, and leading researchers, and that is a new HIV cure research training module program that over the course of the next several months, there will be 17 modules on different aspects of research, both the different strategies that Jensen has described on the call today, as well as different issues about the basic background on science, the ethical and regulatory issues, and special issues in cure-related research. Each of the modules is being developed in a really exciting collaboration between some number of advocates and some numbers of leading researchers to ensure that the information is accurate, but that it's user-friendly and understandable to a wide range of audiences. And each of these modules will include a PowerPoint slide deck to both watch but also to use, pre- and post-test assessments, webinar recordings like this one, video recordings eventually as we go forward. It really is a giant collaboration amongst a number of organizations. And just to give you a sense of timeline, coming up in early October at the United States Conference on AIDS, there'll be the testing of the module on HIV/AIDS and the basics of cure research, and a follow-on community meeting in Washington. And then hopefully by the Retrovirus Conference in February 2015, which will take place in Seattle, there will be a launch of a number of additional modules, and hopefully during the course of 2015, the full 17 module series will be available. Very much a collaboration between a number of advocacy groups, as well as the three logos you see at the bottom of the slide in the right-hand corner, Defeat HIV, DARE, and the CARE Collaboratory, are the three NIH-funded Martin Delaney Collaboratory on Cure Research. And they've really been driving a lot of the science and in partnership with these advocacy groups developing this cure curriculum. And we are incredibly excited about this. Two colleagues are on the line, Jessica Handybode from AVAC and Corinne Dubé from one of the collaboratories who's really driving a lot of this, who's based at the University of North Carolina. Corinne and Jessica's emails are there in the slide. If you want more information, want to be involved in reviewing some of these and being pilot participants in some of these, we'd be delighted. So please be in touch with both Jessica and Corinne. And we'll be following up through the Advocates Network to all, and if anyone does have specific questions, you can reach out to both of them. Again, I want to thank all of you for joining this call, and most of all, I want to thank Chintana for such a terrific job today. And again, please do register for the call coming up in 2 weeks' time. Thanks so much, everybody, and we'll talk very soon.